to the persecuted Palestinians or redress their 75-year-long suffering. At least before things get out of control, it will be wise for Washington to withdraw its navies and close down its bases all over the region in order to avoid the ghastly scenario of sinking American ships and return of the Yankees to the U.S. in body bags. Palestine is for Palestinians, from the banks of River Jordan in the east to the shores of Mediterranean Sea in the west, and from the borders of Egyptian Sinai in the south to the frontier of Lebanon in the north. Thus, no amount of Zionist atrocities and unmanly military support of the West will save the illegal Zionist entity from its fast approaching end.
Hi, and welcome to this edition of Gaza Under Attack. I'm Saeed Puriza, coming to you from the British capital. Over the weekend, Israel began its ground assault. The move saw the Gaza Strip isolated as communications were cut. The death toll from the genocidal attack on Gaza continues to climb, with the majority of the martyred civilians, women, children, the most vulnerable. Let's bring you up to speed with where things are so far. Despite international condemnation, Israel continues its intensifying assault. Ground forces are pushing deeper into northern Gaza. Israeli tanks have been seen on the road linking northern and southern Gaza. Airstrikes have killed hundreds of civilians in the last 24 hours. Nowhere is safe, including the Al-Quds Hospital, that's been warned to evacuate immediately. 14,000 people are now sheltering there. More than 8,000 Palestinians, men, women, and children, have been murdered by incessant Israeli shelling since October 7th. The UAE has called an emergency UN Security Council meeting seeking a binding resolution demanding that Israel accept a humanitarian pause to the fighting. Iran is warning of new war fronts if the U.S. continues support for Israel. Here in the U.K., calls for humanitarian pauses by members of the opposition Labour Party. Still, no call for a ceasefire. So what's next in Israel's genocidal campaign? With me here in the studio to discuss and unpack all of that, broadcaster and political analyst Tede Kofi. And joining us on Skype is Ali Salam. He's the editor-in-chief of Basira Press. He is in Moscow at the moment, but is normally based in Tehran. Gentlemen, good to have both of you with us. Tede, The weekend saw the Israeli incursion into the Gaza Strip after days of waiting for it to happen. What do you make of all of that? What is your reaction?
Well, it was entirely predictable, I think, because the only people who can hold Israel back from such incredible action is the United States of America. And barring forthright action by the United States of America, this was completely predictable. And the scale of the Israeli response has been ramped up by the fact that 1,400 of their own were killed by the initial assault by Hamas. So, if you like, that was always going to be the barometer by which we would have to judge events that have followed, and they have been, frankly, savage.
And let me get to Ali Salam's reaction to that as well in Moscow. Ali Salam, you heard what Tede had to say. This incursion, you know, they said they were going to do it. They waited and waited until we're seeing it happening now, and there's fighting going on between Hamas and the Israeli forces. What do you make of it all so far?
The incursions that they have made are very tiny and they've been defeated and essentially blown out of the water. And every single time they have crossed into Gaza, they haven't made any significant headway because they don't stand a chance. The only places where the Zionist occupation army has any kind of superiority is in the air, where the Palestinians do not, at the moment, have the means to shoot down their airplanes. And so it's in a cowardly fashion, they cannot face real men who belong to that land and who have something to fight for and to die for, and who are on the side of the truth, who are on the side of righteousness, and who are on the side of God. And so these cowardly occupiers who do not belong to this land, who are not on the side of truth, who do not have any morality, they don't stand a chance. And they very much like this temporary worldly life. So they would not want to risk leaving this temporal domain through death. So they will flee to hang on to their life. Whereas the Palestinian loves life, but loves a life of dignity and does not like a life of humiliation. And so they will sacrifice their lives for a much higher purpose, even though it's not like what the Zionist media says, obviously, that we're a so-called death cult or anything like that. So the Zionist regime has no chance of winning, and their sadistic tactic of bombing civilians from the sky has no military strategic benefit for them at all. Maybe it satisfies their psychopathic bloodlust, but it doesn't fulfill any military objectives for them, and that's why they will continue to lose and be humiliated.
I mean, the end game here, Tet, what we saw on October 7th, after, you know, they overcame the initial shock, has been this carpet bombing of Gaza. Mm-hmm. What is Israel trying to do here? Are they looking for some kind of a victory? Because, you know, Netanyahu wants probably to tell people, look, I'm on top of it, because the humiliation that Israel has suffered as a result of that attack, they can never live this one out. And they're looking for some kind of a victory, which is why we've been seeing the continued campaign of bombing Gaza going on for the past 24 days.
Okay. The most difficult thing about the situation in Palestine is that of perspective. They say in property that when you're buying, it's about location, location, location. To understand what's going on in Palestine, the word is perspective, perspective, perspective. And the perspective has to be taken in two dimensions. One, the dimension of history, and the other, the dimension of geography. Mm-hmm. Now, when I called the actions in Palestine, what you're calling an incursion, what I called a savage intervention, it's in response to the fact that this is a wholly asymmetric war. 1,400 people were slain by an attack from Hamas. 8,000, as your figure quoted, I heard 7,000, have been slain since. But the question is that the methodology of this thing is what makes it absolutely brutal. They are holding back water. They are holding back power. They are holding back, and this is crucial, medicine. Now, that is totally and utterly beyond the pale. So if you look at it in the wider perspective, you have to say that notwithstanding the fact that 1,400 Israelis lost their life to Hamas, mm-hmm. this response is completely out of perspective. It's completely off the charts. And it goes to the matter of geography, because it seems, as the gentleman has explained up there, that the only reason Israel would have for taking these actions can only be to create a greater Israel, which itself is a problem, a project which is hugely fraught. They've tried the twin track, the twin state solution, which Israel kicked into touch. Yeah. This is now going on where Israel is going to create a greater of Israel, if you like, shrinking the Palestinians into even smaller areas. And what's going to happen is that the demographics of the place indicate that even within the greater Israel, you would have possibly a small majority of Palestinians.
Yeah.
Now, the only way you can continue to maintain a state in that way is to have hugely discriminatory laws. So for all of these reasons, it seems bizarre to anyone who is looking at this with the perspective of history, with the perspective of our experiences in other political establishments and so on. The only way you can stand this up is by calling a cease, not a halt for a moment. You need a ceasefire.
Not a humanitarian pause, which we will talk about. Yeah. That the figure of 8,000 is more than 8,000. That excludes people who are still buried under rubble. So the number is definitely higher.
Okay.
But I want to talk to Ali Salam briefly as well. And that question to you, Ali, is I want you to address what Tete mentioned earlier, which is Israel's decision to cut off all supplies to the Gaza Strip and taking down all lines of communication.
It's not like that Gaza had a free flow of goods or any such things before this genocidal onslaught against Gaza. The Zionist regime, and also through various pro-Israel and pro-American puppets in Egypt who control the Rafah crossing on the border with Egypt, they helped to basically besiege Gaza. So this has not been anything new for Gaza. It's just been worsened and restricted even further, coinciding with an absolutely brutal bombing campaign. So the sadistic nature of this occupation has been even more apparent during this time. And that's why I would like to actually address the issue of ceasefire versus humanitarian pause and this type of thing, because even if we were to accept a ceasefire, which is a little bit more than a humanitarian pause, is a very little gesture. Mm-hmm. Ceasefire would be kind of like the next bigger gesture. But even that, what does a ceasefire mean? It means just returning to the status quo of before October 7th, which is still miserable for the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. So the actual real thing that we should be demanding is an end to the occupation, because a ceasefire may actually be used to tell the Palestinians they can't engage in their divine, moral, and legal right to armed resistance, that mm-hmm. they have to put down their arms and accept a pre-October 7th status quo. And so the Palestinians have chosen by popular will that armed resistance is the only way forward, because the United Nations is basically the useless nations. It's totally incapable of solving their problems. And perhaps, I think definitely it was designed, the UN was designed to be such a biased organization. And of course, this is the only, they're going to be bombed and they're going to be treated in this way regardless of whether they engage in armed resistance or not. So they're either going to die in a state of humiliation where they don't do anything about it, or they're going to die honorably standing up for their people and doing what is right and paying the ultimate cost for it.
And so far, we've seen them pay the ultimate cost, and they as they have over the past 75 years. Ali Salam, thank you very much, the editor-in-chief of Basira Press, joining us from Moscow. Many thanks for sharing your thoughts with us. We're going to pause here. Tat, stay with me in the studio. It's been another night of horror for those living under the bombardment, but international condemnation of Israeli actions spilled out onto the streets, our streets, over the weekend. Our cameras were at the demos and got the thoughts of those protesting the Gazan genocide, especially when it came to the actions of the British government.
The government here is still not responding. And as a part where, like, I'm doing the taxes and they are paying the taxes to kill our brothers. So it's unfair. It's completely unfair. And I'm disappointed by all this. Like, this, it's like an evil, like, now leading the world. And it's not good to be have this.
It's disgraceful. It's disgraceful. There is no humanity in it. They can't even bring themselves to stop It's not a war, it's a massacre. It's just a killing spree, and they can't even bring themselves to say no to stop it.
Many of us have voted for political parties who are turning a blind eye and basically supporting this genocide. You know, some politicians in this building behind me in the Houses of Parliament have signed an early day motion calling for a ceasefire, and they should be listening to the protesters and demanding that there's an immediate and complete ceasefire, that humanitarian aid is allowed through in serious quantities rather than just one or two trucks with a little bit of water and crumbs for the suffering people of Gaza.
Double standards, clearly double standards. It's like one human life has a different value to the life of a human being who lives in Gaza or Palestine. Exactly, simple as that.
I've never witnessed anything like this. I've never witnessed like actual war crimes happening, and our politicians, my MP is Keir Starmer, saying children are allowed to be starved and deprived water. It's such cognitive dissonance going on right now. I've never experienced actual war crimes happening, and the politicians actively supporting it, green-lighting it, giving it their kiss. This has never happened in my lifetime.
It's not self-defense, as Israel claims. This is genocide, and it has to stop. And I'm so ashamed of our government that they are sanctioning what I think is just collective murder. And it really, really has got to stop. It's awful. And anyone with a conscience would want to put a stop to that right away. It's inexcusable. I'm delighted there's so many people here, and there will be more.
Powerful words there. Now, let's pause the discussion with my guest for a moment and bring in life coach and media personality Fahima Mohammed. Fahima, you've been digging deep into what's happening in the media as far as this genocidal campaign against Palestinians is concerned. What have you found to share with us?
Well, echoing from what we've just seen are the powerful tweets that are sort of echoing what everybody's sort of saying as to, maybe you'll see it in a moment, the amount of people that have actually turned up for these protests. And it is quite a diversity and multicultural support for it, which we're not getting much of the actual, that on the mainstream media. So this massive demonstration in support of Palestine has been tweeted by George Galloway, and it's been retweeted so many times to show that even though there are attempts to ban the protests, it's just getting bigger and bigger and larger. And I think there were reports for around, I think, 500,000 people that may have turned up.
One such attempt came from the Home Secretary.
Exactly, or at least over 100,000 anyways.
Yeah, the numbers were huge. I was there, and I wasn't alone with a couple other colleagues. And for 1 hour, we were standing outside the parliament, and waves of people mm-hmm. would come, and still the crowd would not run out.
Absolutely. Well, now another tweet by sort of Labour Party lady, Victoria Derbyshire. Well, Michelle Donnellan is the Labour Party lady.
Interviewed by the BBC's
Victoria Derbyshire. The broadcaster, Victoria Derbyshire. And she basically goes on saying how much, the enemy is Hamas, and they are at fault for everything that's happening, and the fact that civilians, innocent civilians, are being killed only because of Hamas. So basically they're pointing the guns at themselves.
Regurgitating basically the Israeli line, because they're saying
Absolutely.
We're targeting Hamas, we're not targeting civilians, which is not the case.
Absolutely not. And again, it's a lot of the rhetoric on the mainstream and the narrative to sort of add on to that story that Israel has a right to defend itself because of Hamas. So whether there's innocent civilians, women and children that are in the sort of like, firing line, it is not the when it comes to whoever's targeting them, it's not anyone's fault but Hamas.
And people are asking how you can call that defense even.
Yes.
So many kids. One kid dies every 6 or 7 minutes in Gaza at the moment.
Well, the ambassador of Palestine even said, he goes, if there was a hostage situation even happening in the UK and it was taken into a building, would you just bomb that entire building just for that, hostage? So it doesn't really make sense, but that's the kind of narrative and story that's been put out there.
All right, let's move on to the next story. What else do you have for us?
We have from Channel 4 News, again, Benjamin Netanyahu says that his Israeli army is the most moral and in the world, and they are doing everything to avoid harming anyone, you know, that is not involved. But obviously, as we are seeing footage from the ground, that is not the case. And even targets and places outside the Gaza Strip are also sort of basically civilians being hurt and injured. So I don't understand how this, you know, rhetoric and narrative is still in the mainstream news to sort of, you know, give the opportunity for him clearly showing that his army is not really taking any sort of precautions on civilians. And in fact, they're doing more damage than they should on a normal sort of basis when it comes to this kind of war. But he goes on and on to say that the war crimes is nothing, you know, to do with his army and his sort of soldiers.
Basically, where is the morality in, again, carpet bombing the Gaza Strip for 24 days nonstop?
Yes, nonstop.
I'm sure you have some more to share with us.
Yes, we do. We're going to be talking about also the mainstream media when it comes to Islamophobia and being quite loud and clear when we have the Sunday Express with the huge headline, Ban Jihadi Hate Mobs. So they're basically talking about the protests under the one umbrella of everybody that's attending as actually a hate mob. And they are obviously putting that narrative for everybody else to see. And obviously, they're not winning when it comes to everyday people going out there and protesting and showing that solidarity and support. So that's why they're going to take to the mainstream and have their newspapers and sort of journalists and reporters speak with this, which is clearly, you know, impartial, unfair, and it's really wrong reporting on the facts that are there. And even if there are people that are hijacking a few sort of incidents that are isolated, it does not speak for the majority of people that are actually attending these marches.
They're almost criminalizing showing up to a pro-Palestine protest.
Exactly.
All right. Fahim Muhammad, thank you. I'm sure we'll speak again not long from now. Joining me now via Skype is Shad Abu Salama to continue the discussion with us, with Teddy Kofi here in the studio with me, of course. I was going to ask Dr. Abu Salama, you know, we were talking about the cutting off of electricity and other supplies to the Palestinians. But then we moved on to talking about why is it that despite all the outpouring of public support for the Palestinians over the past 3 weeks, every Saturday, only the, you know, the demonstrations growing bigger and bigger, what we're hearing from governments, as far as the Western world is concerned, is only calls for humanitarian pauses. That is not tantamount to a ceasefire. Why do you think that is?
The history of dehumanization, really, that we're experiencing as a pattern. And it's a shame on all of them that they're lowering the bar on Palestinian lives and our rights to freedom, justice, and equality that have been long denied. I don't know what else to say, really. They are always, the international community is always asking the Palestinians to, remind them of our humanity. But it's actually us that we are asking them to prove their humanity and finally see this intergenerational violence that Palestinians have endured for over 100 years of British and Israeli colonialism of Palestine.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Shad, you are a Palestinian-born academic and activist yourself. You definitely have family there, if not close family, extended family.
I was born and raised.
I was just going to ask you how yourself are feeling, you know, in the aftermath of what we have been seeing over the past 24 days.
I'm feeling devastated, and while I'm physically in the UK, I'm mentally in Gaza alongside my family, who are displaced and deprived of basic rights. At the minute, my family is entering the fourth week of relentless bombardment by Israel that have forced them to leave our home in the north of Gaza and seek al-Nusayrat refugee camp, where a survivor of Nakba, my grandmother, is hosting them, basically. We've been through so much. I was born and raised in Jabalia refugee camp, a third generation refugee. And during 23 years of my life, Israeli violence has gone uninterrupted. And this has been the same for my parents, for my grandparents. And now, the new generation, my brother's daughters, one has been just born 2 months ago, and they're too little, and like over a million of Gaza residents, they are going through these horrors. It's just shocking and devastating, and it makes us feel abandoned by the international community.
It's really hard to find the right words really to describe what is happening there. Horrific indeed, and we're very sorry to hear what's happened to your loved ones. We come to the end of the show. I'd like to thank my guests, Teddy Kofi, Ali Salam, and Dr. Shad Abu Salama, and you, of course, for tuning in. Until next time, goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
In its Fall 2023 Global Economic Prospects Report, the Washington-based economic think tank projected that, on a year-over-year basis, UK real GDP growth would decline 0.3% in 2023 and 0.2% in 2024. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to The Guardian, citing a study by the Washington-based Peterson Institute for International Economics, PIIE, the British economy will shrink in both 2023 and 2024. According to the report, persistent inflation, falling real incomes of low-income households, and a shortage of workers will result in a 0.3% drop in the country's gross domestic product GDP this year, and a further 0.2% backslide next year. PIIE President Adam Posen told The Guardian, the UK won't be in recession all of next year, but the recovery will be held back by higher than expected inflation, and in response, the Bank of England will need to keep interest rates higher for longer. Posen, who used to work on the Bank of England's Monetary Policy Committee, noted that the UK economy is also still weighed down by the after effects of Brexit and will likely suffer from planned cuts to government spending next year. Recently, the central bank refrained from hiking interest rates for the first time in nearly 2 years after a surprise drop in inflation in August to 6.7% amid weaker growth in food prices and a reduction in accommodation and air travel costs. However, UK inflation remains the highest among G7 economies. Posen warned that more rate hikes are possible in the coming month if inflation doesn't slow further. Karen Dinan, a co-author of the report, mirrored the Institute's warning and said it does not apply to the UK alone. She stated, "While inflation appears to be receding in most countries, it remains decidedly above central bank targets. As a result, most central banks will need to keep their policy rates high over the coming year, with the resulting tight financial conditions holding back demand and slowing economic activity." According to CNBC, UK gross domestic product fell by 0.5% in July, below the 0.2% contraction forecast in a Reuters poll of economists. Services output was the main drag, the Office for National Statistics said, declining 0.5%. The economy puts in a better-than-expected performance for the second quarter as a whole, with the ONS reiterating its reading of 0.2% growth. July's surprise dip meant the economy shrank at its fastest pace since December, according to the ONS figures. It is the latest sign of economic strain in the higher interest rate environment. Recently, figures showed UK mortgages in arrears jumped to a 7-year high in the 3 months to June. Major investment bank trimmed their UK growth expectations following the reading. Goldman Sachs revised its annual growth forecast to 0.3% from 0.5%, while JP Morgan downgraded its 2023 forecast to 0.4% from 0.6% and its 2024 forecast to 0.2% from 0.4%. James Smith, developed markets economist at ING, said in a note that, "Cutting through the noise, the economy seems to be still growing, albeit fractionally. We think the economy is likely to more or less flatline over coming quarters amid the recession that can't be ruled out." Paul Dales, chief UK economist at Capital Economics, said the GDP figures may indicate a recession has already begun, and underlying growth has lost momentum since earlier in the year. Dales highlighted strikes and unusually wet weather as weighing on certain sectors, but said output declined more broadly, suggesting widespread weakness. Dales said, "Even so, with wage growth still uncomfortably strong, we suspect the Bank of England will still raise interest rates one final time next week, from 5.25% to 5.50%. A potential concern for the central bank came recently when data showed annual growth in pay, including bonuses, which remained steady at 7.8%, the highest on record. This was combined with a sign of a slight cooling in the labor market, as unemployment rose 0.5 percentage points. The British pound was 0.2% lower against the US dollar at $1.245 at 8:40 a.m. as it declined against euro. Jane Foley, head of FX strategy at Rabobank, said the BOE faced a difficult predicament given strong earnings data and a slower UK growth. She said via email, while the market is assuming that a September rate hike is a done deal, the uncertainty for following meetings is rising. Clearly, too much tightening would risk a UK recession, and this possibility appears a little stronger after today's monthly GDP report. Adding, weaker growth data thus increases the chances that bank rate will reach its peak this month, an outlook which is weighing on the pound recently.
Hidden Files. That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards Black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for Black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down. That opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He's an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa. to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. The tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then but that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country in 1965 and the 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice. They've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list and on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, that tends to lay out what is known as full reparations. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that they don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime, so there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation. We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory on international law to redress the situation in its entirety. The fourth component of for reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity, return, or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of the crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgenerational epigenetic inheritance that that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. Going to take a look at a few instances that have taken a place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And you know, the cotton actually built New York City as the commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, you know, the first thing should be we should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and you know, the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know. So, yeah, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable, make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few quote unquote African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, you know, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, you know, as treated like domesticated animals, you know. So they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal, you know, even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans. And we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So, you know, so yeah, so these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles or like we were some type of plants or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, you know, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved. We were tortured. And to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote-unquote third-world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, you know, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time. And we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
According to the Euro-Mediterranean Monitor, the number of those martyred and missing in the Gaza Strip since the start of war on 7th of October has now exceeded the numbers of victims in the Srebrenica genocide. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Al Jazeera television network has covered this story and tells us more. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, expressed concern about the catastrophic situation of Palestinian children in the besieged Gaza Strip, which has been under a genocidal Israeli bombing campaign for over 3 weeks. UNICEF spokesperson Toby Fricker said the number of children massacred in Gaza is catastrophic. Fricker said in an interview with the Qatari-based television channel Al Jazeera on Sunday, 29th of October, The situation for children is horrific.